Good morning. We've been experiencing technical difficulties with the host of Rise Up, the Baker podcast, but those issues have been resolved, and we now return you to our regularly scheduled broadcast.
How crazy it seems to have a dream to open and run a bakery, but they took a chance, took the sweets to the street.
Hello there, bakeroos and bakerettes. Welcome to the Rise Up podcast. I'm your host, Mark Dick, and this is the show about bakers and bakeries and bakery owners and all the folks that work so hard, often through the night, to make the good stuff and to share it with the people in their community. How are you this week? I'm back podcasting. My goodness. These delays that I have caused myself. Sorry about that. We are back and we're going to be back for the next few weeks, back to a weekly show. Like I say in the introduction, it's actually going to be a weekly podcast. So I'm happy for that. I'm back in Victoria. Cindy and I were off in Vancouver last weekend, partaking in all that the bakery industrial complex has to offer. We were at the bakery showcase for the Baking Association of Canada, had quite a bit of fun, had my eyes opened. Some things rocked me to my core, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. But it was a good weekend. Don't get me wrong. Today on the show, though, I have a really fun conversation with a fella named Ron Bokenfor, who is a farmer and a miller and an engineer, and he's just outside Edmonton, Alberta, in that little sliver of land between Edmonton and St. Albert. He's got a really interesting story to tell about regenerative agriculture and sprouting grains and milling sprouted grains and shipping them all over. And we have a fun talk about what's the future of agriculture in the big areas, the Great Plains of the world. So that's a lot of fun, and that's coming up in a minute. But first off, there's time for some shout outs and some gratitude and some words of thanks to a number of people. First, to Leah Hayward, who has been working as the production assistant on this show. Leah's been the person for the past few months sending out invitations and coordinating calls with guests for the podcast. Leah's working really hard, and she's still going to be helping out, but it's the start of market season for her and Smoor Bakery in Sydney, on Vancouver Island here. We're going to see if she can keep up with the work she's doing with the Baking Association and the Market Bakery and being a mom and taking care of her little one and helping me out from time to time. I think it's too much. She works so hard, but she's doing a great job, and I really do appreciate the help that she's given me and given the show over the past few months. And so we got to ride together. Cindy and Leah and I took the ferry across to Vancouver for the bakery showcase. And it was fun just to spend 90 minutes and having a really good visit while the world passed us by and the islands and the mountains and all of that. So it was fun, and it was nice to see her live and in person. So shout out to Leah. Shout out to Kyle Greer. When we came back from Vancouver, there was this huge box waiting for us, full of stone ground flour from Panarchy Mills in the States. Kyle was on the show last year, and he was talking about the mills that he was building in the U.S. based on a style of mill that he learned and worked with in Austria. And I got 3 bags of flour, and I am super excited. I'm going to be providing full reports on the baking that comes from that flour that he sent. But I took a quick look last night, and it looks gorgeous and smells gorgeous, and so it's going to be great. So thanks, Kyle. I cannot imagine the effort involved in shipping 25 pounds of flour up to Canada from California, but I really, really appreciate it. So thanks to Kyle. Thanks to Colleen Cross, right off the hop. Colleen was and is the editor of Baker's Journal magazine, and she was sort of the lead on setting up the bakery showcase. She works with Annex Media, who does a lot of work with the association. And Colleen and her crew were just fantastic. to Cindy and I, both in preparation for the event and then at the showcase on the weekend. And it was nice to finally meet her in person. We'd been on Zoom a lot over the last year, and it was nice to finally meet up with her. So shout out to Colleen and to Dina, who does the social media stuff there and made me look pretty darn intelligent, which is a feat. And so congrats to Dina for pulling that off on the Bakery Association Instagram feed over the weekend. That was pretty nice because I got to prove to my kids that I actually stood up and gave a talk thanks to the filming that she did. So it was fun. That being said, it was a bit of an odd event. It was created a lot of dissonance in my mind. And I think it was because the bakery showcase, much like I believe IBIE is down in Vegas, is a trade show. It was a little intimidating, I will say, for me to walk into that. And it was the dissonance, I think, was because my first career before I started baking was in telecom and in software and data centers and that kind of stuff. And I used to go to conferences and trade shows, you know, down in the States and across Canada as part of my work. I even helped man a booth selling our managed hosting and data center services for SaskTel back in, I think it was 2006 down in Orlando. And, you know, so I was part of that where y'all wear matching polo shirts and or starch white dress shirts with dark pants and, you know, everyone's of the same age and the same, we're all the same and we're all there and we're all selling our stuff and we have these booths that say like, we are part of a global network and that kind of stuff. And you take all the software and the machine and the data centers and the computers out and you put in robot production lines and massive machinery and that kind of stuff and then surround it with food and you're kind of there. Yeah, that's the convention center in Vancouver. And so it was a really strange personally to be part of that. And I actually had to talk to a few folks and say like, so what do you make of all this? And they're like, yeah, this is cool. Cause you know, yeah, I'm never buying a robot cake decorator, but I've got some ideas with some of these other vendors that I can talk to and stuff. And it's like, okay, awesome. Good. I'm glad because it seemed a lot for me. And maybe it was triggering past events when I was wandering the trade show, trying to learn about, you know, this software solution versus that software solution. But, yeah, I didn't fit in then and I don't know that I fit in now when it comes to the trade show part of this. But you know, as much as this was a trade show and you know, they put us on as speakers like super early in the morning before most of the people came, but people came to the talks and listeners of the podcast came to the talks and independent bakers came to the talks. And they listened and we talked and shared ideas and it was beautiful. It was really, really good. Yeah, I gave a talk on telling the story of your bakery. I tried to sum up everything that I've been thinking about and doing and some of the stuff that I've been teaching through workshops and put that into a 40-minute talk. And I did my best. And after the talk, I had conversations with four or five folks that were kind of went beside the stage afterwards and we were yakking about things. And honest to goodness, their questions just set off so many ideas in my head of things we need to talk about more on the show, things they need to write about, things we need to share with Bakers for Bakers. Just kind of, it was so great just to meet people and talk to people and hear their feedback and hear questions about this that don't quite make sense or my situation's a little bit different. What do you think? And just kind of banging ideas back and forth. It was so much fun. And so thank you to all the people that came up to say hi after my talk and after the amazing panel that I was part of even earlier when all that was around was people setting up their booths and guys vacuuming the carpets. and a dozen or so of us talking about starting a bakery in those early days and what it's like on those early days. And Adam and Jess and their one-year-old came over on the ferry from working Culture Bread in Victoria and shared their experience of their first 2 years of business and starting a family as part of that and what that was like. And Dale and Cass from Tall Shadow Bakery, who will be coming on the show, but they're right in the throes of opening. And they took the time on a day that they could have been building out their new bakery, and they came down first thing in the morning and spent time on the panel sharing their story from making that leap from market bakers and being part of their community in Vancouver and saying, nope, we're going to make the commitment. We're going to build out a space because we can serve the people in our neighborhood even better. And they were open and honest and vulnerable about how scary that is. And, you know, it was so beautiful because in and amongst all of the production lines and the bakery industrial complex that was the trade show, in our little corner, we were talking about the fear of opening and things are going good at the market garden or at the farmer's market. Maybe should I be opening up my own place? That seems like a hell of a leap. And I want to make that leap to building a team, but that seems scary. And how can we overcome that? When you are a single person working at the farmer's market, do you even know what grants are available to you? And I, from the government, from the Canadian government, the provincial government, that kind of thing, what small business programs are there? What small employer programs are there? I didn't know. And the folks on the panel didn't know, but the people in the audience knew. And so this panel discussion became a conversation with the five of us on stage and the dozen or so people in the audience. And that was beautiful. And I absolutely loved it. And, you know, I want those folks that were in the audience to know how important that they are. And I want you to know that there is a place for you. I know that Martin's working hard to say that there's a place for you in the Baking Association of Canada. Karen Bornarth was there from the Bread Bakers Guild, and I know for the folks in the States that she's working hard to say that the Bread Bakers Guild is a place for you to come and to learn and to help each other and to support each other. And I want you to know that Bakers for Bakers is there for you. And that's the people, whether or not you felt comfortable in and amongst these international conglomerates of vendors talking to each other, I want you to know that there are places that are there for you to help each other out and to get the help that you need so that you can make a big deal in your own community. You know, maybe you're not going to cover the entire Eastern Seaboard. Maybe you're not going to cover, you know, you're not going to be shipping on containers to send your stuff overseas. Maybe you're just going to be serving the folks in your neighborhood and the one next to your neighborhood. And that's okay. And there's a place for you. Come to Bakers for Bakers, bakers4bakers.org. Share your stories, share your questions, share your fears. And together, people that have done what you're doing can help you. And you can help the next folks that are coming up. Okay? So it was great. And I do think that everyone who attended, big or small, got something out of the bakery showcase. And that's awesome. And if you got a little bit out of the stuff that I was involved with, that makes me feel great. And if we never got a chance to meet, I apologize. Reach out. We'll connect up a different way. I thought that I would have the headspace to spend more time just visiting with people. And I found for myself, being part of the two talks that I was part of and listening to a couple of talks was a lot. And then I needed to go find ice cream. So I didn't spend as much time as I thought last week that I was going to spend sort of on the convention floor trying to meet folks. And so if you were looking for me and you missed me, I apologize for that. Oh, and I want to bring up two other things that I saw there that I wasn't a part of, but I was grateful and glad to be a spectator of. One was very briefly got to see my friend Tracy as I was walking off the stage and she was going on the stage for a panel about women in baking. So it was nice to see her, and it was nice to see the people that she was with on the panel from the Vancouver area. And then after my talk on Monday morning, I went across to the other stage where it was a very tiny group, sadly a very tiny group, talking about paying a living wage and what it means to pay a living wage. But I talked to the woman from the Living Wage Association, the group that's really promoting this in British Columbia, and we're going to connect up and we're going to have a chat for the podcast to talk about this idea of a living wage, what it means for employees to get paid enough that they can actually afford to live where they work, and what does that mean for employers? And I've got a lot of reflections just from that talk, from that one panel, that I'm going to save for another podcast here. So because I really want to start turning the attention now to Ron, who's coming up. But I think there's some really exciting things and some really good conversations that we can have about wages and labor and employees and living wages and that kind of thing. So I'm excited for that in the next few weeks as well. So I've been talking far too much. Ron Bokenfor is coming up here, and Ron's really the guy that you need to be listening to. So Ron, like I say, he's a farmer. He works on regenerative agriculture and converting his farm to regenerative agricultural practices in North Central Alberta. And he's also into milling and sprouting grains and then milling those sprouted grains and shipping that around Alberta and hopefully a little further afield in the coming years. I know just the tiniest little bit about regenerative agriculture and sprouted grains and the benefits to us and to the planet by some of these techniques. And so it was really nice to talk to Ron and get his insights into this. I'm curious to know at the end what you got out of this and how it might help you at your bakery. So let's talk to Ron Bokenfor, and then we'll chat more about this after. Here we go. Hey, so it's nice to meet you.
Yeah, it's great to meet you.
You're just northwest of Edmonton?
Well, yeah, St. Albert. I grew up here. It used to be a drive into St. Albert, but now I can see it just across the fence line.
It's all connected, eh? Yeah.
Yeah, it's getting pretty close.
Yeah, I haven't been up there in years, but like last time I was at Edmonton and I went up to St. Albert, it was because I wanted to see Lois Hole's Garden Center, because I'd read all her books and stuff, and I thought, well, okay. So I always thought of St. Albert as the garden city. But I've since met a baker that's up in St. Albert too. What's her name? Laura Jorgensen.
Red Love?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. Fantastic lady.
Yeah, she's awesome. She's awesome and has been doing good stuff. I've talked to her a couple of times over the last few years. So yeah.
Yeah, she's using some of her flour. We've got about 10 artisan bakeries that are using our flour now. So
oh, cool. Okay. Yeah. Oh, right on.
Getting started.
Oh, for sure. Well, and so are you farming as well as doing all, or I guess sort of, I was on your website and I was looking at all the things that you're into, and I'm just sort of like, okay, I'm like sort of what, where are you in the whole scheme of things?
Right. Yeah. So I grew up on the farm just outside of St. Albert. Mm-hmm. And, my mom, bless her soul, wanted us to go to university, so I took engineering. And then, but I've always loved farming, and I've always farmed. So I designed refineries and petrochemical plants for a few years, and decided it would be fun to build the ag processing plants.
Okay.
And marry that engineering with ag that I've been doing. So we built an oat mill back in 1989.
Oh, wow.
And and I ran that till 1990. We were doing about 300 tons a day of oats. So that got boring. And I sold that to my partner, and then I went on and did a bunch of other stuff, and not related to ag, but I always farmed. And now we started up a little mill just to promote regenerative ag, really. And that's kind of the thing that's going to be fun about it, I think. It's just, I would have thought that it would have caught on quicker, but it really hasn't resonated that much with the conventional ag guys yet.
So. Okay. I'm not sure I really understand what regenerative agriculture is. I'm wondering if you could help me with that.
Well, I'd like to say I'm an expert, but I'm not. So I'm sure you're going to find a lot of people that know more. But there's conventional agriculture, which kind of relies on yield, right?
Right.
You do whatever you can to get more yield so that you can make a little more money. And that's gone crazy. We're, 10,000 acres, 20,000 acres now. And I don't know where it's going to stop with the average age of the farmer being 105. I suspect that we're going to see, that numbers just keep going up, right? Then there's organic, which means you can't use any spray or any fertilizer. But to do that, that basically means you have to till the soil to kill the weeds. So regenerative is more about the biology in the soil. It's trying to get that biology back that's in the soil. Because in a teaspoon of soil, there's more bugs living than people on the earth, right? So, and then that biology is really designed to take all the nitrogen out of the air and get it ready for the plant to use, and to help solubilize the phosphorus and elements that are in the ground. So that's kind of a cool thing. And I came onto it about 2018. I talked to David Johnson. He was designing a way to make compost without moving it so much, so that you would get more fungal biomass growing in it.
Okay. Anyway,
yeah. So regenerative ag, to answer your question, it's more about trying to get the biology going in the soil. If you do that, you don't really need the fertilizer.
Right.
So, but the main difference between that and organic is you can still use spray.
Oh, okay. Okay. And so then the getting the biology in there, is that like techniques like cover cropping and that kind of stuff?
One of the five key pillars is diversity, trying to get more different plants growing, because that plant that then feeds the soil microbes. It's the sugars that the roots leak out into the soil that feed the microbes in the soil.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you kind of convert your farming practice into sort of adopting some of these techniques?
Yeah, it's a process, I would say. It's something that you can't really do cold turkey. I know some people do. They just cut off the synthetic fertilizer. But then it's about year three where you have a hiccup and you have a real wreck, right?
Mm-hmm.
So as expensive as everything is in agriculture, you can't really afford to have that. And the stress of having a wreck is what keeps everybody pouring on the nitrogen and fertilizer, right? So, it's a fun transition process. Most people recommend cutting back gradually over 3 or 4 years. Some people, if you have enough organic matter, can get away with cutting back 100% all in 1 year on your fertilizer. But it's really about stimulating that biology and trying to get compost extracts, compost teas, other things that you would put down for sure as a seed inoculant, but also putting it in the soil to get that microbial population back.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So long-term process for sure. Right. But it's, kind of took a while to get to that point. So it's going to take a while. If you've been conventionally farming a piece of land for 50 years, it's going to take a while to to get the balance back, right?
Right. And the balance is a key word because like we pretend to be God and we do a soil analysis and we say, oh, we need just a little bit more of that, a little bit more of that. And nature has a way to balance it just automatically. It's fantastic how all the microbes and everything talks to each other. And we know so little about it, not just me. That's obvious.
Yeah.
But, you know, the scientists, everybody, it's, you can't even name all the different biology.
Yeah.
We know a fraction of them. And we only know a fraction of what they do. So, and then there's the quorum sensing, what happens when you get a whole lot of them together in a small space, how they work as a team together to accomplish the goal.
Yeah.
It's amazing what we're learning as a, you know, about this as we go. So it's pretty cool.
Sure. Sure. Does it change, or has it for you, has it changed the types of grains that you're growing?
Well, it's we're growing more and that's more different varieties and different
right.
things. And what we're doing is different as well. So we'll put down two or three different seeds with our canola, for example. And that gives the diversity for the biology to at least get started.
Right.
Some of that might die out as the canola grows, but you want to have that living in the understory so that when the canola or wheat or any crop basically gets to start to ripen and the sun can penetrate that canopy now and get down to those plants, then they just take off and you have a living root living in the soil later on in, you know, July and August, because as the plant starts to focus on putting energy towards the seeds, it naturally stops putting energy towards the roots. And then, so the biology gets put on hold. But if you can have a living root growing throughout the whole growing season, then you're feeding that biology and increasing it. So.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, then I talked to someone, last year, I think that was the first time I ever got my head around that you're actually going to plant three seeds of three different things all at the same time in the same spot. So it's not like a rotation in terms of plant one, all of one thing, then all of the next, then all of the next. You're going to plant three at once for different reasons. And
right.
And I guess in the example you shared, it's sort of like you're going to harvest one and get benefits from the other two, kind of a thing.
Yeah, like you might have a white clover growing down at the very bottom that wouldn't get harvested, right?
Yeah.
But it would still be there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then it's producing nitrogen on its own for the other crops and stuff, right?
Right, right.
So,
and if you've got sandy land like my dad and grandpa had, you know, if you're holding on to it some, you know, as well, right? Like just having those that extra root mass. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't blow away.
That's, yeah, yeah.
Luckily, ours is either growing or frozen. So
yeah, yeah,
doesn't go anywhere.
No kidding. Yeah. Although I like, gee whiz, I remember back in the mid '80s, you know, where my dad had been back farming at my grandparents' farm south of Moose Jaw, and they had drought and no snow cover for a couple of years. And my God, the way that the soil blew off in the spring, just, you know, big, like 6 feet deep gullies down to the hard pan and stuff. Like it was crazy how poor it was, dirt and not soil. That's for sure. You know? Yeah. Which is, I guess, part of what this whole practice is about, you know, getting it back to this is soil. Like this fits right here. Yeah.
Yeah. So diversity is one thing. And then having a cover, an armor on the soil, like a mulch.
Yeah.
Is another key factor. It might not be quite as important for erosion up here, but it is for erosion. It's also for keeping the ground cooler, right? You get this insulating layer. You don't have the sun scalding on it like on a sidewalk where you could fry an egg. So then, you know, that high temperature of a bare soil doesn't help the biology. It kind of kills all that biology until the temperature is a little cooler further down. And you also, it just keeps the moisture in too, right? You don't get that ground drying out as much by having a cover on it.
Right, for sure. Well, and so you're also into, you know, like sprouting and milling as well, right? And I'm really curious about the sprouting side of things. We did some sprouted grain breads at our bakery in Saskatchewan, and I learned it from when I was out in San Francisco in that, but I never really seen it sort of at scale, you know? So, you know, it's sort of like you'd get a bucket of wheat and 5 days later, you might, you know, have some sprouts to work with. Like what are you doing in that regard?
Right. So the idea was that regeneratively grown grain is higher in nutrient density normally. And so to sprout it then would increase that again. So sprouting gets rid of a lot of the anti-nutritional factors because there a lot of the grain is designed to go through an animal and grow on the other end, right? This way you get it started to germinate and it reduces the phytic acid, some of the lecithin, some of the anti-nutritionals that tie up all of those nutrients. So by sprouting it, it makes it more available to your body to absorb, right?
Right.
It also increases antioxidants and vitamins and phytochemicals and all kinds of other things, changes the protein into essential amino acids and things like that. So yeah, there's all of that. And it also tastes so much better. So
it really does. Hey, like that was the eye opener for me for like, even on forget the sciences, the flavor was crazy. Yeah. It was really good. Yeah.
Yeah. We've got one, customer here, a bakery in Edmonton, and they just they'll buy a few bags and they put a little bit into everything that they do just for the flavor. So yeah, we actually got going with it, and we designed and built a sort of a 20 ton batch for sprouting, which is fairly substantial, and we can sprout it and dry it down and
so you sprout it and then dry it and then grind it like you would grind a flour then.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So you're able to, like the bakers around there are able to get actual sprouted grain flour.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause my only experience with that was the grains wouldn't be dried yet. And so we'd run them kind of through like a meat grinder and just to kind of mash them up and stuff and then mix that into as a supplement or as a mix in into our doughs and stuff. Right. But back then, like I just couldn't find it. I kept on hearing of places like you that were making the actual flour. Yeah. Yeah. So that's got to be quite the operation to both sprout it at scale like that, like you said, 20 tons, but also dry it all before it can go to a milling process. I guess just like from an engineering or mechanical perspective, I'm kind of in awe of all of that. Yeah.
Yeah, I find that stuff quite easy to do, and it's nothing that special. Making it repeatable, controlling the moisture, the temperature, the air, the temperature, everything, that's a little trickier, so that you have reliability and consistency and stuff. And just getting all your SOPs in place for your food safety stuff, it's always something to do.
Yeah, my brother-in-law is down in Calgary and he's a process engineer, right?
Okay.
So and so he's into all, he owns a recycling company. So they get all kinds of offset or discarded materials and that kind of stuff. And then they turn it into useful products and he's got the mind for it, right? It's like, oh, if I built a machine that could do this and this, I can transform, you know, this scrap lumber into something that going out the door that's useful here. Right. And that middle bit, you know, with the machining process and stuff is like, I can't understand any of it, you know, and I can understand it when he describes it to me, but the fact that he came up with this and he's like, okay, if I can find a metal guy to make this to this spec, I'm going to make a pile of money because I can turn, you know, waste into gold kind of a thing. I'm like, okay, good on you. There's people that can build this stuff. Oh yeah. Yeah. So
it's so cool. And how fun is it to get to play around with different.
Oh yeah. Things, you know? Oh yeah. Yeah. Like I've got a lot of respect for that. And for like what you do, just like sort of, you can, well, I need a machine that can or I need a setup that can take 20 tons of grain and sprout it all consistently and safely and all of that stuff, and then dry it properly and, you know, and get it out the door. Huh. That's like, that's really cool.
Yeah. Well, and you got to use, you can't use direct fired air, like a grain dryer or something like that. You've got to be indirect fired. So
right.
Kind of the products of combustion are going into the food and stuff, but
yeah.
So there's little tricks to it for sure.
Yeah. And so then your company, so are you like trying to do this sort of at a large enough scale that you can then start shipping product around the province or around the country kind of a thing?
Right. We're actually right beside the container yard here. And I was thinking, you know, it'd be nice to do a 20 ton batch so that you have the same product in a container, right?
Right.
Or in a truckload of stuff. In a perfect world, we'd really like to supply Edmonton, Calgary, you know, like Winnipeg to Vancouver, kind of Western Canada. There's not really anybody else that I know of that's doing this. Silver Hills Bakery makes bread, much like you said, with the wet mash kind of process. There's another guy that's been doing it for a long time in Toronto. So we're hoping we can supply anybody that's interested. And it would really be cool if somebody wants to, you know, really make a different product, right? Say, Ron, could you grow me this unique variety of grain and then sprout it? And then, you know, it's just for me and I got this fantastic pizza crust, you know?
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. Sure. Something. Yeah. Well, and I guess that's the thing. It's like connecting with curious bakers. So that you can do some tests and trials and experiments and spread your wings, I guess, about what you can do with what you're making.
Right. That is the real key. I mean, I wish I had a serial chemist in my back pocket because it would be a lot easier. I don't know anything about baking. In fact, my wife really very rarely lets me in the kitchen. So, only to clean dishes, I think. So if I knew that end of it a bit better, it would help the process. But I do know you can't learn, you can't know everything. So knowing a bit about the farming and a bit about the milling is good enough for now. And we're getting going. We've got one customer who's super guy and super group, basically, that's interested in making sprouted oat milk.
Oh, nice.
We're hoping that grows well for them and we can be of service to them. Yeah. That'd be fantastic.
Yeah. And you said you were there, you've got some bakers nearby that are using your flour and that kind of a thing. Is this something that's available for purchase, like from other bakeries or what stage is that at?
Yeah, absolutely. We've been milling flour for about a year now.
Okay.
Todd at Brio was one of the first customers in Edmonton. And I think he says he's got some of our flour in every product he makes now. So I don't know how much more we can push to him. But there's probably 10, I'd say. Especially we've added a bit of rye flour now. So that's been fairly well received in Edmonton.
Nice.
We've been doing a bit of barley flour for the Ethiopian market.
Oh, okay.
Grinding a little bit of teff as well to let them make injera. It's their flatbread.
Okay.
What else have we been doing? Oats. We've been growing a bit of hullus oats and grinding it into flour as well as sprouting it. And
what kind of milling setup do you have? Like what style of mill?
Right. We kind of were unsure. We picked one piece of equipment when we started and it didn't do what we wanted. So we took that out and we just went back to the basics and we put in a stone mill. Everybody seems to like the stone ground flour. It's surprising how much you have to be there and it's kind of nose to the grindstone, right? So if you don't have enough capacity, then all the profit is just in labor. So Then we added a pulverizer mill to that so that we could do the other end of the spectrum and get it a little finer. So we can stone grind and then regrind, and that way we can kind of control a little bit of the starch damage and some of that stuff.
Yeah. And a pulverizer mill, what's that like?
Oh, it's just this god-awful big 100 horsepower thing. It sounds a little bit like somebody's starting a 747 in your office, and it just goes nine. I think I figured out how fast it's going, but it was like 300 miles an hour or something like that, the tip speed.
Right.
It's just screaming. And so it relies on impacting the grain and the grain hitting each other, and it just pulverizes everything up.
Yeah. I think that's what the kind of flour that I was getting from my miller when we had Orange Boot Bakery is because it was one of those, everything, it wasn't like a roller mill because everything that comes in comes out the other side kind of a thing, but it definitely wasn't a stone mill. Yeah. It made really good flour. Like I quite liked it, and it was very consistent, or I thought it was very consistent from them. But I have a real soft spot for folks like you that are doing like sort of independent milling and that kind of thing. Because like in Canadian terms, like it's not easy to set up or an independent operation like you've got, or at least from my understanding, sort of being separate from the wheat board, then, or you have to be to do all this independent stuff. Or how does it really work?
That is a great question. I don't know.
You're just doing it.
Yeah, I think you can do whatever you want with your own grain.
Gotcha.
Then if you start buying grain from somebody else, then the grain commission will monitor your bond that you would have to post just to say that you're going to pay everybody, right?
Right.
But that's, I don't know that you have to buy grain off of the wheat board anymore. I can't remember how that works. I know back in the day when in 89, when we built our oat mill, the government had a bunch of meetings with us. And because we decided to build this oat mill, they took oats off of the board.
Okay.
It was us and a couple other guys that were going to build mills if we didn't have to buy the oats off the Canadian wheat board anymore. So,
okay.
I think most of that is in the past.
Oh, okay. Oh, good. Yeah. Because I just remember talking to the two millers that I know in Canada, right? So it's a huge sample size, but they were both outside of Regina, and I bought from both of them, and they were organic farmers and millers. And they were sort of explaining how from an organic farming point of view, it was all kind of separated off, and, you know, they had their own network of people that they bought from, but that was kind of it. And the reason that it was important to me was because I got my head full of ideas after taking some classes in the States, and it's like, and everybody's talking about all these independent mills that they're buying from. And I'm like, yeah, give me more of that. Right. And so I've started looking around, and there weren't too many, you know, back in the day, and I couldn't figure out why, you know, you could buy from Ardent Mills or I could buy from my friend Nicole, but there was nothing in between. And that was sort of the learning back then anyways. Yeah.
Yeah, there's quite an investment to get to the truckload scale, right? Because once you get to that, you got to have your food safety program and HACCP, and it goes on and on and on. So there's quite a few guys that could get a stone mill and throw it in their garage or whatever, and that doesn't cost anything to set up or anything like that. But then, you know, if you want to go to the next step and you want to try to get out truckload quantities that kind of match the volume of a farm, then it starts to get a little tougher, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. That's the sort of the scalability or the problem with any kind of industrial operation, right? Like you've got a couple of hurdles. You're a couple big steps in the journey.
Right. And then you're competing against flour mills that have been around for a long time that are fully depreciated, and they're doing, you know, economy of scale.
Yep.
Because they have this longer process that needs more equipment to get the bran off. Right.
Yeah.
Then it's it's not a great area to be in. Yes. If you're trying to compete against white flour, right?
Because yes.
But I don't get it. Like, why are we mostly consuming white flour? I get that it's easier to bake with, maybe, and it makes a lighter, fluffier product. But everything I read is it's not as healthy for you as whole grain flour.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, no, you're exactly right there. And I think there's, well, personal opinion, you know, I think there's a cultural tradition, I guess, you know, that it's sort of like for 60, 70 years, it got beaten in you that, you know, white bread is better bread, you know, tastier or whatever. And it's certainly sweeter, you know, that kind of thing, or not until you get sprouted flour into the mix. And then, right. and then it's just like any kind of processed food, right? I can make it, I can abuse the ingredients and make something an awful lot cheaper and mass produce it, you know? So then you get, you know, what's available at Walmart and stuff. But there's I think the trend for anyone that has access to good bread and good products made with whole grains and interesting whole grains, like some of the stuff that you've even mentioned, like, yeah, then it's night and day different. It's a whole other product and it's awesome.
Yeah. Like we get to, grow, parkwheat. We used to grow parkwheat back in, when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you how long ago that was, but, it was bred in the 60s for the Parkland region, and it was grown for a long, long time. It was the one wheat that everybody grew for a long time. I don't know. Everybody that I've been taking it to loves the flavor of.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I can. And you hit the nail on the head of the thing that's really got me interested in a lot of folks is this idea of, well, here's wheat that grows really well where you are, you know, like the Parkland region kind of a thing. Yes. Excellent. And so that variety, you're not going to try and spread around the world. You know, like I was
right.
Yeah. I was talking just a couple of weeks ago to some folks that are just on Lopez Island here, but on the US side. And yeah, they're talking about, you know, finding wheat varieties. The farmers there finding wheat varieties that grow very, very well in that Pacific Northwest region, which is entirely different than what would grow for you or what would grow even in Southern Saskatchewan, right? Or what folks would want to grow. And it's like, yeah, all the power to you. Like, grow it all and have it taste different, you know, have different products wherever you are in the world. There's nothing wrong with that. Yeah.
Right. This year, we're going to grow a little bit of hard white wheat.
Nice.
So that it'll make a little whiter product. It's a little sweeter than the hard reds. And
Well, and yeah. And so what are you hoping for, I guess, in the next, you know, this year and the next couple of years for you and the company and all of the things that you're kind of working on? Where are you hoping to go?
I'm just hoping we can get some food manufacturers or restaurants that really want to make a unique product, you know, and I think we'll be competitive. It's kind of funny when you look at the price that a small bakery pays for a bag of flour. It's mostly freight, it seems like, or a big chunk of it is freight anyway, you know. Mm-hmm. You know what the bigger bakeries in town are paying, and then you look, well, these guys are paying $4 or $5 a bag more, sometimes a lot more than that. Yeah, I think we'll be competitive. We're working with a couple of distributors that are probably going to take our product so we can get a little further reach away from Edmonton and maybe get to Calgary or Vancouver. And so Bakemark, I hope will carry on and promote and work with us to. There's a bit of a gap in the middle there between what we're making and what a customer might want, right? So it's not going to, even this white wheat is not going to perform exactly like an all-purpose flour.
Sure.
We can sift out 15% of the bran and it'll still have 75% of the nutrition of a whole wheat flour, but it will be way better for you than a white flour, which is maybe only got 15% of that nutrition left, you know?
Sure.
So those are all things that we can do. We can kind of grind as coarse or fine as somebody wants. and sprout it to whatever degree they want. But it's all a matter of working with somebody to perfect the product that they want to make, right?
Yeah.
So there's going to be a little bit of give and take and education on everybody's part, mostly mine.
Yeah, but even I think for the bakers and the bakery owners that listen to this that are going to be listening to the show, and I know there's some folks, you know, right in your area of the world that listen to the show and stuff, and it's like there's also some give and take in terms of on their behalf in terms of sort of the quantity that they want to bring, that they're going to need to bring in. Or maybe a few of them getting together to make it sort of fit with the scale that you're at, right? Because there's, you know, like the smaller bakers are gonna need smaller quantities, I guess. And so you're not gonna want to change your whole setup for that smaller quantity, is what I'm thinking.
Well, I don't know if that's really true.
Because, okay.
I mean, we're servicing those guys now.
Right on.
And we're, you know, we'd throw a pallet in the back of the pickup and we'd drive it down and get to meet people. And that's the best part of the whole thing, is all the people you get to meet and new friends and all the rest, right?
Oh, sweet.
Learning a bit about their life and the miles that they're walking, their moccasins. So that's all doable. And even with the sprouting part of it, even if we do it at a bigger batch, sprouted grain lasts for a long time after it's sprouted. We don't have to mill it until the day before the guy wants his order.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
10 bags or whether it's, you know.
Oh, okay.
Pallets, right?
Oh, neat. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So as long as it's, once you dry it, it's stable again.
Sure.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And in fact, it's maybe more stable than, even the flour is more stable than an unsprouted flour, because some of that, I don't know, the germ doesn't go rancid as quick.
Really. Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, then there you go. Yeah. So the folks that like, you know, like Yvonne and Larry and that I've got in mind here in Edmonton, it's sort of like, no, that's exactly the kind of a setup that I think they could work with. Yeah. That's awesome.
Now, the hard part is trying to economically cut the 10 bags to the person, because even me getting, you know, minimum wage, I hate to pay myself much. You know, by the time we're 5 minutes out of town, so we're half an hour to somebody in town. So yeah. It just, there's a bit of cost to getting there, you know, whether
totally.
It's $2 a bag or three or what, but.
Oh, totally. And no, you're dead on. And that's the, you said it already about how, you know, it seems like commodity flour, like all you're paying for is the freight, because the freight is not trivial.
Right.
When we had the bakery and the closest miller, he retired and kind of sold off his stuff. And so I started bringing from Nicole, who was in Estevan. So that's a couple hours away. And the freight costs were, well, it was all of it. You know, it was sort of like, okay, whatever increase in price, and, you know, my price of flour doubled basically because of, and it was all freight costs, right? Because, and I get it. Like, she's got to roll a truck to drive 2.5 hours into town. It's going to cost more for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And we're lucky. We're right on the edge of town here.
Yeah. That's all.
I mean, we farm both sides of Ray Gibbon Drive, which connects to Anthony Henday, which goes around the city. So. It's funny when you go to talk to some of the bakeries in St. Albert, and you say, well, we used to farm behind the church, and like, that's been houses for 20 years.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. Like it just keeps on growing. Hey, like,
yeah.
So hopefully you can keep farming it and it doesn't turn into condos or something, but,
Well, it was funny. I remember when I was 20, I thought I'll get squeezed out of farming by the time I'm 30 or whatever. And then I got to be 30. It was like, well, maybe by the time I'm 50, the city will. Yeah, I'm like, shit, I'm like Freedom 95.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, well. Well, what did I miss, Ron? Is there anything you wanted to get out there that I haven't asked you already? I want to make sure I get.
No, I don't know. It was a fun conversation. I think we covered a lot about the benefits of regenerative ag. I mean, we didn't really talk about how regenerative ag can sequester CO2 from the atmosphere and get it into the soil, which I think is going to be something that's going to get more and more important.
Right.
And other things like organic, which works on more tillage, is you know, it's burning up that carbon, that organic matter in the soil. And even zero till has a long period of, you know, years to increase organic matter, where this regenerative ag seems like they can increase organic matter and sequester CO2 in the soil where you want it super quick. So that's pretty cool. And by having that there, it absorbs a lot more water. The ground becomes a sponge for the water. That's an important thing. I mean, some of the scientists are even saying that the global warming isn't a CO2 thing. It's a water moisture vapor greenhouse gas. Oh, interesting.
Gas. Yeah.
So then it's going to be all about agriculture trying to solve the problem. Yeah, I think we covered a lot of that just having fun doing.
Yeah, and I guess I'm curious with the regenerative ag side of things, I guess, are there things that, that you're involved in to sort of grow the understanding or the adoption of that kind of practice? What's the regenerative agriculture scene like where you are?
You know what? It is, I've got to go to a lot of conferences about it. There was a fantastic one a couple weeks ago showing how, you know, we always thought that microbes would fix nitrogen for legumes and pulses, but it actually showed how microbes are being taken right into the plant, stripped of all their nutrients as a feed source for the plant. The plant decides which ones it wants, and it spits them back out through the root hairs. Huh. And without those microbes, if you sterilize the seed, you don't even get, like, the seed can't tell which way gravity is. The roots will grow sideways, the roots will go up. And then as soon as you inoculate that seed with bacteria again, it starts to grow. So, yeah, it was fantastic to go to some of those things and see some of the young kids that are taking this on. And they're like sponges absorbing this information. And there's great WhatsApp groups of and lots of different ideas on how to make microbial inoculants and fertilizers, much like in a garden, but on a commercial ag scale now.
Right.
And it's bringing a whole lot of hope into the next generation, because they don't have to have this horrific amount of debt and risk, you know.
Right. So, and debt sort of from that cost of inputs every year, right? Like is that sort of the biggest factor?
That's one of the big factors for sure. I mean, it's money that goes out the door that you don't get back each year. And if you have a crop failure, you know, you're that much farther behind. Like, we're one of the smaller farms now, and, you know, you're still spending $250,000 on inputs every year.
Wow.
And, that's just fertilizer and spray and maybe fuel, but that stuff just is stuff you don't get back if you get hailed out or dried out, right?
Yeah.
You invest in your tractor and you got those payments, well, yeah, it's still there, you know. It hasn't, that value hasn't gone away. So, yeah, just reducing the inputs, I mean, it reduces the risk to the point where you don't even really need crop insurance. And so that also makes it fun for the next generation, right?
That are trying to
think about how can they take over a farm.
Yeah, so this might be the thing that keeps young folks in farming, in growing good food, that kind of a deal. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's all been very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Well. Good luck to you for sure. You know, and thanks for I guess educating me on the both on the sprouting side of things and the regenerative agriculture side of things, because it's sort of two things that I didn't know that like much about at all, and still don't, to be honest with you. But I'm inspired by the work you're doing, and I hope that that you're able to keep you know, making the company and the operation that you want out of this for sure.
Oh yeah, it's great to meet you, Mark, and thanks for having me on the program. I mean, it's fascinating what you're doing as a resource for all of the people that are passionate about baking. Man, that's got to be the toughest job going, middle of the night. Holy mackerel!
Yeah, it's well, I don't know. The folks that do it seem to like it, so that's good.
Yeah, and a good group of people. I've never met anybody that's, you know, not loving it. So.
Well, I think what you're trying to do, what you're doing, it lines up and I think appeals to a lot of the bakers or the kinds of bakers that I know, right? It's like there's some basic goodness in the goal. There's some sort of basic goodness in the goals that you have that lines up with what the bakers are trying to do. So there's some good synergy there. And so I'm hopeful that this conversation is going to get a lot of people thinking more about regenerative agriculture. I got to get used to saying it. But regenerative agriculture and sprouted grains and how they can kind of incorporate that into the products they're making and the conversations they're having with their customers and the whole thing, right? Because we you know, at our bakery, we used to put a little sign up. We would have an open house every year and we'd say, like, here's the miller that we use and here's the farmers and that kind of a thing. And trying to show people that, hey, it's all connected here. It's an important thing that the bakers can do to say, hey, look, you know, we're getting our flour from Ron here, and this is what it's all about. And this is what he's doing to try and make the food that we're serving you better and the land that he's farming on better and so on. Right. It's a good message to spread.
Sure. I mean, even just knowing that, it's frustrating for me knowing that I go to buy a loaf of bread and I'm like, well, the flour is coming out of some big place. And the 90% of the grain is coming out of some big place that has probably been desiccated. And I'm like, man, why don't we have options to eat local and know where it's coming from?
Yeah. You know? Just give us the good stuff. Absolutely. Right on. Yeah. Well, yeah. Good talking to you for sure. All right. That was fun. The really informative for me, you know, my idea of a small farm, like I did not grow up on a farm, but my grandparents farmed and we were there every weekend. So in a way I kind of did, even though, you know, during the week I lived in the city. But a small farm when I was growing up was a section of land. And a section of land is four quarter sections. Each quarter section is 160 acres. What a strange way of dividing land up. But anyways, so what's that? 640 acres is a section of land. And Ron's talking about, you know, small farms being 20,000 acres now. And I'm used to like 640. And it just shows you how much the world has changed in this sort of growth of agriculture. And it's like, you need 20,000 acres now to support your family. And what's up with that? And so I really applaud Ron and what he's doing with this idea of like, let's not just treat this as a growing medium, you know, let's treat this as a living ecosystem, this soil, and let's do good things for the soil. And as a result, we can harvest based on that. And I think that's awesome. And it's really cool to me to know that there's folks that are both sprouting grains and then also then drying it and making it into flour so that we can use it at our bakeries. And I'm going to be keeping an eye out in my area for products like this, and hopefully you can, and give it a try as well, because it opens up some really interesting opportunities, both on the flavor side of things and on the health side of things. And then the last thought was this, and it's just talking about building up the soil with regenerative agriculture again. And I remember reading a book by Bill Bryson talking about the human body. He was talking about all the microbes, you know, and gut health is so important these days. And they're talking about, you know, all the microbes that make our body function. Just like Ron was talking about all the microbes in the soil that are actually teaching the seeds and are required to teach the seeds how to grow roots properly and how to make the food that they use. And that you can't just have a neutral medium because the seeds don't know what to do. And Bryson made the point of, you know, who's really in charge here? Like, we as people, are we really the primary thing here? Or is my body just a transport mechanism for all the microbes that are in my guts and they're really steering the ship here? And, you know, when you talk about mood and brain chemistry or digestion and how digestion is tied to health and all of that, I don't know. I don't know that I'm in charge here. Maybe this whole podcast is just something that my microbial masters need, and I don't understand why they need it. But so from my microbial masters in my gut to the microbial masters in your gut, maybe there's some communication happening there and we're just the carriers. I don't know. We'll think about that for the week. I hope you enjoyed the podcast this week. You can tell I'm kind of all over the place, but I'm grateful to be back talking with you. We have a great talk in a totally different dimension of the bakery world coming up next week. Can't wait to share it with you. Until then, please work hard, be healthy, be safe, take care of your gut. Happy baking. Bye-bye.